Fortunately, we're going to be going back in history when things were more peaceful and talking about that. So we're on page 127, if you can see, find that. That we're going to be looking at the First Crusade. And a lot of times that's where we pick history up with the Crusades, is right in, you know, the year 1095. And the church starts invading, you know, invading the Middle East, trying to take Jerusalem. And again, as I've taught it in church history, some of the things they were trying to do is they're trying to regain the holy sites. They wanted the pilgrims to be able to visit the tomb of Christ. They wanted to be able to visit the burial or birthplace of Christ. That's where Jerome, even way back in 200, 300 AD, there's a monastery there where, you know, they're, you know, very early in history in the, at the birthplace of Christ, which seems to be authentic. But anyway, the pilgrims wanted to travel, and, you know, the Christians, and visit. And then also they had conflicts, and so they had to have knights transport them and protect them. And then you get into all the crazy doctrine. And you can come out real negative towards the church if you just approach it from Western history, and especially Protestants describing it as, because the Catholics were the ones. It was the Latin church, the Roman church, going into the Greek Orthodox church territory. And fighting, you know, whoever they fought. And so as a Protestant, you can be kind of negative towards the Crusade. If you're not a Christian, you can be easily negative towards the Crusade because it's not Christ-like at all. But as we looked at last week, and I'd like to have you go back to that. Well, I'll go out back to page 124, and you can see the train collision heading there. You can see all the places listed that the Muslims, they had attacked Italy's west coast. The Muslims, they had conquered Marseille in France. They'd attacked Rome and destroyed churches in Rome. They'd conquered, completely took Sicily and Malta, burnt Monte Cassino a couple of times. They'd plundered Madrid, Barcelona, Pisa. They destroyed the holy sites in Jerusalem. And the other train on the western side of the western world, it names all the cities that had been taken or fought the Muslims, as the Muslims invaded. You go to the map on page 125, and all those places going all the way over to Spain and all the way over to the Atlantic Ocean coast, going all the way up into France, all along the coast, and all those islands in the Mediterranean Sea, including the city of Constantinople, which is up there on the Black Sea, which was the head of the Roman Empire at that time, or the Byzantine Empire. Rome was still functioning, but it was under the control of the Pope. It wasn't the head of the Roman Empire or the Byzantine Empire. Rome was the head of the church at that time. And the church, of course, was controlling the government in much of this map, which causes a problem. But the actual Byzantine Empire, the eastern half of the Roman Empire, was controlled by Christians in Constantinople. And that's where Constantine moved. All of those places had been attacked or defeated or were under the control of Muslims, and it wasn't a pretty scene. It wasn't like they negotiated their way. They slaughtered their way through. They burnt priests. They killed priests. They decapitated priests many times in their own churches. They took over entire villages, killed the men, sold the women and children into slavery. And that was going on that map between 750 and 1517. So, basically, the Pope was getting help from the German leaders to help hold Rome up because the Muslims were attacking Rome. They'd entered Rome, and he had to pay them to leave an annual amount of silver coins to get them out of the city. So, as we left off last week, the Crusades were, and kind of like I talked about last night, you're in this situation where there's no good options. It's like, what do? You just let the Muslims overrun the land, or are you going to fight back? Well, we're going to fight back. Well, it's the Church of Rome that has to engage the battle because they're the ones that have taken over the government. So now you've got the church who controls the government instigating some kind of a warfare to defend the Christians individually, their territory, their families, their culture. And so it's just like you don't have any choices left. You're going to have to go to war for the sake of Christianity. And how's that going to come out recorded in history? And so when you look at it from that perspective, you get a whole different angle on the Crusades. If they don't have the Crusades, they're going to be overrun by Islam in 1095. The Western world will fall to Islam in 1095. So they fight back. and now they're fighting back, and now they're the bully. You know, it's one of those lose-lose situations. You ever remember being in school, you're getting picked on, and if you just take it, you're going to continue to get picked on. But then you step up and defend yourself, and you get sent to the office, and now you're being aggressive. And it's kind of like raising boys, I had to explain it to them. I mean, you've got to try to negotiate your way out of a situation. You've got to go tell the teacher, this kid's giving me a bad time. But if you can't negotiate and no one's going to pay attention to you, you've got to hit them fast, you've got to hit them hard, and hit them in the nose so there's a blood scene. And it's like, and you will go to the office because they didn't make you bleed, but you stopped it. You'll go to the office. You'll come home. You'll be suspended from school for a certain amount of time. I'll support you, but you better make sure you try to negotiate your way out. You better make sure you've already told the teacher, try to get some help from the school. And if no one else is going to stand up and help you, then you drop the kid, you drop him fast and make sure he's bleeding. And when you go back to school after your 3-day suspension, it'll be a different world. I mean, you may have the teachers may be watching you, but the kids are going to start treating you a little different. And that's kind of, is that good advice from a parent? Well, I shouldn't even put that on a video, but it's like that's the world. You negotiate, you try to get some support, and if not, unless you're just willing to lay down and be picked on the rest of your school career, you better start dropping kids. And I mean, hitting them in the face, not bringing your gun to school and shooting up the building. It's like, oh my gosh, you know, now I'm in deep water. I got to edit this whole video probably. No, Okay. So my reason for saying all that was that's where the church finds themselves in. You can be critical of the church. I have been critical of the Crusades. Their doctrine's strange. Well, we'll see some strange things. But if they don't do something, there is no Western world. There is no Renaissance. There's no what we would recognize as the development of freedom or democracy in the Western world. There's no America as we know it today because history would have changed. In fact, if you would allow yourself just to think a while and you know don't accept this as fact, but this is aiming towards the end times here in 1074. I mean, you're on the track to where the beast is going to take over unless the church fights back. And I think, apparently, historically, that's what God was intending. Otherwise, Jesus would have come back. But yet today, it's so similar. I guess what I want you to see is the similarity. It's like, are we pushing the envelope now? What are we going to do? Okay, here we go. 1074 on page 127. Because of all those things that had taken place, Pope Gregory VII begins to call for crusades against the Muslims in the Holy Land who were harassing Christian pilgrims. They're trying to get down and visit the holy sites, trying to rebuild some of the holy sites that have been destroyed by the Muslims. The Byzantine Empire of Constantinople had asked the Western European Christians for assistance against the Muslims invading Asia. And so over there in Constantinople, he's staring down Muslim invasion constantly. They've already laid siege to Constantinople. So he's on the front lines and looking over to Rome saying, can you help me? Rome's looking up to Germany and says, we've already been invaded. Can you come down and help us? So Germany's helping Rome, who's calling for crusades. And the emperor of Constantinople says, we need some help over here because we're going to fall. So, and we went through some of this last week. So between the years, the first crusade is 1095 to 1099. 1095 to 1099. And again, you're dealing with, well, just here's the situation. The first crusade begins when a popular contemporary preaching personality known as Peter the Hermit, again, just imagine if they had television broadcasts back then, stirs up some disorganized knights and common people to follow him into the Holy Land. So he's got his own ministry, his own TV program. He gets everybody fired up, and they're going to march to the Holy Land. They're going to go in there, bring your guns, bring your sword. They don't have guns, but bring your stuff, and we're going to go to war, and we're following God. And he's got a vision. So they follow him. This is known as the Peasants' Crusade or the People's Crusade. But realize this is, you've got two levels happening here. You've got the Pope, who's organized a military already to defend Rome and has for years at this point, saying we got to get organized. Let's get some German knights helping us. Let's go over here and fight. Well, that falls down into the common folks. And this Peter the Hermit, who's got his own private Bible study in a basement in West Des Moines, he gets his own group and he takes off without the Pope's consent. So you got the organized church and then you've got the underground church, if you would, not underground, but the grassroots church. And the grassroots church takes off. And as you read on through here, this early phase of the Peasants' Crusade, the grassroots church, was a failure from the beginning. They leave before the rest of the armies were ready. you know, the organizer trying to get things organized. They leave a trail of destruction across Europe, and most of them die before they even get into Turkey to meet the Muslims. They die on the trip. After crossing the straits into Asia Minor, whoever's left, they're cut down in their first major encounter. So they finally do cross into Asia. The Muslims are waiting for them. They're warriors, and just slaughter them as they come across their first encounter. So that first phase is done. It amounted to nothing. But between 1097 and 1098, the next middle part of this, now you're going to have the German knights leaving Germany, and they slaughter Jews, and they give you the name as they're marching towards the east. They slaughtered the Jews all the way across. And one, they thought the Jews were siding with the Muslims. The reasons would be, as someone was saying last week, one, they wanted their money. I mean, they need to finance this battle, this war. And so they kill the Jews and take their money. They were prosperous. They were successful business people. And they are also just, you know, as Christians always do, blame the Jews for killing Jesus. And so might as well start at home, clean up the house, and march east. So many of the Jews were slaughtered. They arrive at Constantinople in the spring. So this is successful. They arrive at Constantinople. That's the head of the Byzantine Empire. And they help enforce that. And they cross over and quickly take Nicaea, which is in northern part of Asia up in that area. They arrive at Antioch, which was Paul's church. So if you can see my map I drew, or you can just imagine where Paul's church is, where all his missionary journeys came out of. So they've come from the northwest of Asia Minor, northwest Turkey, Constantinople, Nicaea. They've crossed Turkey, and now they're down into Syria, Antioch, right there kind of on the northeast corner of the Mediterranean Sea. And they arrive in Antioch by fall, and they kind of spend the winters laying siege or near Antioch. They got to kind of wait until springtime, and then in the spring, they take Antioch. So now, within just that trip, quickly, they're through Turkey into Syria, and they're in control. This is very successful. This is the highlight of the Crusades. By June of 1099, they've conquered Jerusalem. And like I said last week, as they come through Israel and they come to the place where Samuel's tomb, which is the high place of Gibeah. You go to the Old Testament where Samuel anointed Saul, and it was that high place looking down on Jerusalem. Jerusalem is considered a mountain, but actually this part, Gibeah, the high place of Gibeah, that's where Solomon had gone up and offered sacrifice. The tabernacle was there, or a form of the tabernacle after it had been burnt in Shiloh. Some remains surfaced at the high place of Gibeah, and that's kind of where Samuel offered or anointed Saul. But anyway, the Crusaders arrive there, and they see Jerusalem for the first time, and there's a lot of stories about what they see, what they thought, and the emotional state of having come all the way from Germany, and now they're standing at the high place of Gibeah looking down on Jerusalem, which again is high, but you're not from this location. You got to go from the south and look up, or from the Kidron Valley and look up. But nonetheless, it's a major moment in Crusader history when the Crusaders arrive and see Jerusalem. And there's many, even there's still many remains of Crusader activity on that mound, that high place. Okay, Jerusalem is captured in June. They arrive, take Jerusalem. And this is, when you hear negative stories about the Crusades, there's many of them, but this is one of them. In 1099, because the Muslims in Jerusalem did not surrender, they kept fighting, there were no prisoners that were taken, and everyone in the city was killed. The soldiers, all the men, the women, the children, they slaughtered everyone. And even some of the writings of the Crusaders, as they record these events, they think they're living, just again, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I'm seeing, as many people do, not that we're accurate or right, but you parallel the end times with where you're living. It's like, oh, this could be, we could be entering those final days, you know? We could be nearing that tribulation, the return of Christ. If that's the case, who knows? But the Crusaders, when they're slaughtering the Muslims in Jerusalem, they even record it in apocalyptic terms. The blood was flowing on the because they all ran to the Temple Mount. Not that there was a temple there, but the Dome of the Rock is there. The Al-Aqsa Mosque is there. And that was a higher place in the city with some kind of protection, fortress style. And that's where many of the battles, there are many people slaughtered there. And it says the blood flowed to, they record it as the blood flowed to the horse's bridle. I mean, they're seeing themselves fighting Christ. Their artwork demonstrates that they saw Christ leading them in victory, with images from Revelation being painted into their own, you know, art. It'd be like us, our newspaper articles, our blogs, we're all tying these things together. So again, I'm not being critical of them, because I would do the same. In fact, I am doing the same thing. I'm just presenting it and backing off, not saying Jesus is coming back, you know, next week. But anyway, it was a great time for the Crusaders, because they're bringing the kingdom of God and they're wrapping their eschatology in. But it's a black mark on Christianity, because they just slaughtered people in the name of Christ. So when someone wants to be critical and say, well, the church did the same thing, yes, right here it is. They just walked in and slaughtered anybody that would not surrender. And it just happened to be Muslims in this particular case. But again, it's a hard spot, because what do you go, if you don't do this, you say, well, they're a peaceful religion. You can say whatever you want to, but in this history, a historical account, they're invading city. They're trying to push themselves into Europe. And if you don't stop them, they're going to come to a town near you and take over. I'm not talking about today in America. I'm talking about that was history. So you either negotiate your way out, just let them come in and become Islamic or Muslim yourself, or you fight back. And how are you going to fight back? Just kind of throw some stuff at them and they'll run away? Or you're going to have to go in there and slaughter them? I mean, it's a terrible, history is just terrible. I mean, you know what I'm saying? It's like, after the fall of man, this is where we're at. So I'm not justifying it. I'm not supporting it. But I'm certainly not saying they were wrong, because otherwise Islam would just take over. You've got to stand up to the bully. But when you stand up to the bully, you're acting like a bully. So I don't know. There it is. They take Jerusalem. And many people were slaughtered. The Crusaders set up, again, at the end of bottom, page 127, they set up a feudal system like the one they had left in Europe. And that's not unusual like us. If America goes over there, what are we going to try to set up? We're going to try to set up a democracy. So they came over from Germany and they tried to set up a feudal system, because that's what works best. That's what they were raised with. The Crusaders set up a feudal system. Many of the castles were built and can still be seen today. In other words, you're given certain territory. There are lords and there's knights and there's a castle. And they'd protect you as you farm the land. And there'd be a castle where everyone could come for protection. And there'd be the knights and the lords in the castle. I mean, those castles are still there. Muslim pressure on Constantinople is reduced, obviously, because they've lost Jerusalem. They're not going to worry about Constantinople. And the Knights Templars are organized to protect the pilgrims. And now the pilgrims can come and go and visit. And that's part of their religion. I like to go to Israel. I would encourage you all to go to Israel. But there's no special holy blessing if you get to Israel. I mean, there's maybe information, maybe some experiences, some insights. But you're not going to get a special place in heaven or have some visitation from an angel because you go to Israel. But in their doctrine, and you can understand, I think it would be wrong to say that if you go to Israel, God's going to meet you there on Mount of Olives, you know. But they're talking that you're going to have special revelations. You're going to have special insight. You're going to have special blessings. It's worth going. And so if that's the case, we've got to make sure there's protection for the pilgrims to go. Bad doctrine, and it led to their behavior. Okay. So that's the end of basically the First Crusade. The Knights Templar are escorting people back and forth. Muslims are coming and going. And the Crusaders rebuild, for example, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And what you see today of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre is mostly Crusader rebuilding. And they rediscovered the burial seat of Christ, burial bench of Christ, because it had been covered up when the Muslims destroyed it, and they uncovered it. There it still remains. And they chipped it away. The pilgrims chipped it away and took it back to Europe. Okay, the Second Crusade begins in 1144 and continues up to, what is it, 1155? Is that what we got here? In 1154, Muslims threatened the northeast territory of the Crusader kingdom. And so if you think northeast territory, you're thinking up in Galilee, up to the northeast in the Galilee area. Or here it says Edessa, and we're moving up into Syria further up. A mystic preacher in Europe. So the Muslims are regrouping and coming down from the north. Mystic preacher in Europe, his name is Bernard of Clairvaux, preaches for a second crusade. European interest and motivation is low from the beginning. I mean, they don't have newspapers, they don't have, you know, on the scene camera reporters telling you what's going on. So it's like, It's really hard to motivate people for something that's happening far, far away, especially when I thought we already took care of this. The King of France and the Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire lead the crusade, which fails. So you get the King of France, and of course they're interested because they've been overrun by Muslims, and the Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, that include Italy and the areas controlled by the Holy Roman Empire, even going north, lead out the crusade. Many perish on the way. They fail to retake Damascus or take Damascus, and the Second Crusade ends as a failure. It is in this battle right here in 1187, at the Battle of Hattin, the knights of the Middle East Crusader kingdom are slaughtered. Now, that is in Galilee. And if you've ever been to, and we were there, it's on the, if you imagine Galilee, here's the Sea of Galilee, and here's Capernaum, and here's where the Jesus preached the Sermon on the Mount. There's this place, when you're sailing across the Sea of Galilee, heading towards the west, you can see a mound right here. I know when we went the last time, we didn't go up there, we looked at it, but when we went one time, we went all the way up here, and we're looking down around there, Arbela, caves of Arbela, because there's cliffs there. And I could tell you stories about Herod fighting criminals or bandits and stuff there as he pulled them out of their caves. But if you go up there, and it's like a straight drop-off, and you look over here, you can see there's a plain, and there's a rise, a little high spot here, another high spot here on the plain, kind of up on top of that mound. And that's where it's called right here, the Battle of Hattin, or the Horns of Hattin are right here. And that was the knight's last stand. They came in with their armor. They came in there fighting like they're fighting a knight's battle, and it was hot. They didn't have water. They're in tin cans. And if you're fighting somewhere else, different terrain, it's different. But they're fighting guys on horses that are dressed for the weather using arrows, and they basically are slaughtered. So the knights that were controlling this part of the knight's kingdom, or the crusader kingdom, this part, all their leadership was annihilated right there that day. And that was huge. 1187, the Battle of Hattin, the knights of the Middle East crusader kingdom are slaughtered. On the hill known as the Horns of Hattin, west of the Sea of Galilee, Saladin defeats the Crusader knights by cutting off their water supply route to the Sea of Galilee and burning the fields around them. So they're surrounded by burning fields in the heat without water. And it's just a matter of just time watching them cook. Saladin captures 50 Crusader castles, not 50 Crusaders, 50 Crusader castles. So that's like this county seat of 50 counties. Not that he's threatening them, but he's in control of them. So that whole Crusader kingdom is now collapsed overnight. And soon after the victory of the battle at the Horns of Hattin, Saladin recaptures Jerusalem because of there's no protection. This is like the barrier between the Muslims that were gaining strength in the north. This was the barrier. They had to win this. When they lose this, it's just a day's trip to Jerusalem. Or 2 days trip to Jerusalem, and there's no protection. The pilgrims that are there, the crusaders there, are once again isolated from their home base. So that's the end of the Second Crusade. The Second Crusade never got off the ground, but during that crusade, that led to this confrontation here. And now the romantic ideal of the crusaders, that day has come and gone so fast. So all, you know, the knights and all this and the pilgrims, It's over by 1155 or 1187. Okay, 1189, the Third Crusade, known as the King's Crusade, with the King Philip of France, King Richard of England, and the Emperor Frederick. That's the Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. So here they go. Okay, you got three great leaders going to lead their people. They head off. Then again, they're wearing armor. Emperor Frederick drowns on the way, slips off his horse into water. Oh, blah, 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 blah. He's dead. Okay, it's like the romantic stories are gone. King Philip goes home after having an argument with King Richard. It's like, well, I'm not going to go. You go do it yourself. So now you got one left. One drowned, one gets mad and goes home. King Richard continues and engages Saladin in battle. And this is, again, one of the great leaders. Saladin is one of the great leaders. I would even say one of the great men of history at this time. He was a great, great leader. And he's pulling the Muslim empire, or the Muslims together, and defeating Europe on his own turf. King Richard is defeated by Saladin. Richard the Lionhearted loses the crusade to Saladin, but European Christians are promised access to Jerusalem as pilgrims. So once again, you can see right there, Saladin as a man allowed, even though he won and crushed them, he still, it appears he respects their religion. He's not under any pressure, but you can still come and go and visit your holy sites through his territory. 1200 to 1204, this is the fourth crusade. So again, basically what you got right there is a failure of a crusade at the hands of a great Muslim leader who was compassionate enough to say, if you want to come visit, just, you know, maybe it's wise on his part. Maybe you'll stop fighting if I let you come touch a stone in Jerusalem. Bring your change, too. We'll have some gift shops set up. 1200 to 1204, the fourth crusade. Both are attempts to take Constantinople back from the Muslims. So again, realize Constantinople, the Byzantine Empire head, has fallen to the Muslims. It's a Christian disaster from 1200 to 1204. The original goal was to take Egypt and then use Egypt as a base to recapture Jerusalem. So instead of coming across to Europe and down through Constantinople and through Turkey, they're going to go down to Egypt, then come in from the south. What a brilliant, you know, that's worth thinking about. You can see the war room thinking. Before the crusade began, the Pope went to war with the German knights. Okay, great. Now the Pope's invading Germany. Okay, sounds like a typical Christian organization. The massacres them before the crusade begins. One Christian sect, the Cistercians, preaches against another Christian sect, the Albigensians, and massacres them before the crusade begins. So you got Christians massacring. But again, the ideal of, you know, the war, the crusades, the fighting, they just bring that concept home and start slaughtering each other. And it's going to continue through the Protestant Reformation of Christians in Europe, Catholics killing Protestants, Protestants killing Catholics. It's going to become, when we do church history, it's an ugly, ugly scene because everyone's fighting for their doctrine, and what they've learned is to fight with the sword and slaughter people. And okay, and that's why people like we hear about John Calvin, I forget the guy's name, where he had him burnt because he didn't agree with him on the Trinity, and that's one of the big marks on John Calvin. But the thing is, he was, and I don't appreciate John Calvin, but again, John Calvin was just doing, if you find a heretic, what do you do with a heretic? You give him a chance to repent, then you kill him. And so he had him burnt at the stake. But anyway, that's going to continue on. But here's an example of Christians slaughtering Christians. Other crusaders cannot pay for their transport ships from Venice. They are forced to conquer a Christian city in the Adriatic to make payment to the Christians from Venice. So they want to leave Egypt, but they don't have money for the people from Venice who's got the ships to take them. So they, just a minute, we'll be right back. They go kill a bunch of Christians, conquer them, take their money, says, here you go, and they get taken. They did it in the name of the Lord. I mean, the logic is just really failing here. But once again, we talk about that in the book of Judges. We talk about that, we mentioned it last night, in the days of Sodom and Gomorrah when Lot was in the city. It's like when you get into situations where you've made so many bad decisions, you have no options. We got to get on a boat to go save the Christians, but we can't use the boats until we pay the Christians who need money for the boats, so we're going to kill the Christians to get the money to pay the Christians to take us over to save the Christians. It's like, it all makes sense when you're in the situation, but when you step back and you're in our country, in our situation right now, but I fear, and again, I don't want to start preaching, but I fear our country is working ourselves every day further and further into situations where we are eliminating, we're going to be coming up with ridiculous answers for problems that all the answers are gone. We've eliminated all the options because we've recreated the reality. And that's what's happening in these crusades. They're out of control. They're doing things backwards. They're off center. And anything they decide is going to end up being ridiculous. Ultimately, the Western crusaders from the Roman Catholic Church merely conquer Constantinople. So did you hear that? The Western Christians from the Latin Church in Rome, basically all they get done is they march over to fight the Muslims, but they don't get any further than Constantinople, the head of the Christian Empire, the Byzantine Empire. And so because there's a conflict, they say, well, let's just take this city. So they conquer the Byzantine Empire's center and take over. So basically Latin church Christians are controlling the Eastern Christians' headquarters because they need to do things their way. And took control of the Eastern Greek church for the next 60 years. So the Pope and the Western church in Rome is controlling the Eastern church. And that's the result of the Fourth Crusade against the Muslims, is the Eastern Church gets conquered by the Western Church. 12:12. I always have a hard time taking this serious. And it's in my framework book. It's in this book. It's in Crusader history. But it's like, I'm waiting for someone to say, this is a joke. This is bad information. But it's called the Children's Crusade. Children from France and Germany are sent to fight under the leadership of two boys, Stephen and Nicholas, who are not yet teenagers. Grab a couple 6th or 7th graders out of my shop class, and some of those guys are 7th graders, or teenagers, and put them in charge of invading Islam in the Middle East. And one of the the logic is this. Well, here, the church's theory was these boys were still pure and sinless. Well, you haven't been with little boys very long if you still think that. Just come to my shop class for a couple days and you'd say, okay, that's bad doctrine. The church's theory was that these boys were still pure and sinless, which meant they would be honored by God and successful in battle against the Muslims. I guarantee you, people are going to be laughing at your prosperity message in the Western world someday, just like we laugh at this. If you'll give this guy money, God will bless you. It's like, that's manipulation. That's somebody teaching you bad doctrine. You go, okay, that sounds good. It sounds good to you. But you guys see, they thought it's sin. The reason we can't defeat the Muslims, look at us, we're sinful people. I've got problems, you've got problems. We got to find someone pure. And they preach us like, everybody bought into it. Send some boys over there. Children, they'll win because they're sinless. If you're sinless, God will give you victory in battle. If you have sin, you won't get victory in battle. It's simple. You got Old Testament examples. You preach it. You make it popular. Everybody understands it. You'll send the children to war. And that sounds really ridiculous. So does the prosperity message when you think about it. But we can't hear it. We can't. It doesn't sound ridiculous to us because it's like, yeah, it's all about making money. It's like, uh-huh, yeah, you keep thinking that. Someday they'll laugh at that just or say, I don't understand this. This seems like a joke. That you thought you'd become rich because you were a Christian. You live a good godly life, God will make you rich. Really. That's why the Rolling Stones are so wealthy. Okay, many died, name your favorite secular artist. Many died on the way, and those who made it to the battle were captured and sold into slavery in Egypt. Well, I mean, did you need to hear the end of the story? So 1219 to 1221, the Fifth Crusade. Another plan to invade Egypt succeeds with securing of a strategic Egyptian tower. Again, the idea is get to Egypt, come in from the south. Muslims offer the Crusaders Jerusalem. It was successful enough where the Muslims say, okay, here, you want Jerusalem? You can have Jerusalem. The Crusaders run short of supplies during their inland attack, retreat, and are defeated. An 8-year peace treaty is signed. And so basically this ends up in just, we won't fight you, as you can see, an 8-year peace treaty. They ran out of supplies. Typical Crusader style, disorganized, run out of supplies, weren't ready, wearing tin suits into, not tin, but you know, armor into, you know, the Middle East in June to fight a battle. Okay, the Sixth Crusade, 1229, focuses more on negotiation than military conquest. At least the Crusaders have made a dent that they can sit down and say, okay, let's talk about this, otherwise we're coming back for some more. The Pope Gregory the Ninth and the Holy Roman Emperor Frederick II want to retake Jerusalem. Frederick backs out, so the Pope excommunicates him. I'm not going to go to war with you. Well, then I'm going to kick you out of the church and you'll spend eternity in hell if you don't go to war with me. Okay? Frederick makes a treaty to take Jerusalem, but it did not include possession of the Temple Mount, so the Pope excommunicates him again because the Pope wants the Temple Mount. Frederick secures for the Christians through negotiations with the Muslims safe passage to and from the cities of Jerusalem, again, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, Bethlehem, that's where Jesus was born, Nazareth, that's where they have a holy site where he grew up, and a road to the sea. They need to get to the sea and back so that this is main highway so they can get on boats and not be, you know, hassle all the way in. So those are the three cities they can visit and a highway they can travel on to get to the main route running through there. So Frederick basically negotiates these things, but the Pope doesn't like it, and he gets double excommunicated, which you never want that to happen to you. Okay, the Seventh Crusade. Now, again, just notice the year. So we're hitting 1250 here, and we have the Crusades starting right around 1100. So we've had about 150 years of this Crusade mentality. And again, like I said, I can justify it trying to save Christianity because the Muslims are like, it's not like they're going all the way across the world to kill Muslims. The Muslims have come all the way across the world and are killing and taking over European cities. And so they're back trying to, but in the process, things get out of hand. They lose focus. They lose direction. Seventh Crusade. King Louis IX of France goes to Egypt. Again, they're going to use Egypt as a base to attack Jerusalem. Christians attempt to defeat Egypt, the center of Islamic power at the time. The Christian French king Louis IX is captured and is held until a ransom could be paid that is 50,000 times the entire annual revenue of France. Now, I mean, there's a thousand jokes there. If our leader, our president, got captured, would we spend 50,000 times our entire annual national production to get him back? Or would be, anybody. But they spend 50, what their country makes in a year, they spend 50,000 years worth of that kind of money to get him released. I think a good leader would say, I can't even produce that much money in a reign, so just keep the money and consider me a great leader. But anyway, he gets set free. The Eighth Crusade. This failed crusade ends the Christian presence in the Holy Land. And hear that. It ends the Christian presence in the Holy Land. The Christians had lost Nazareth, Jaffa, which is near the sea, and Antioch, the Syrian city. The Christian plan is to take Tunis, a city on the north coast of Africa, for a base to attack and secure Egypt, and from there they would take Jerusalem. Again, kind of like a preoccupation now with Jerusalem. It seems that there's not much talk here about keeping the Muslims out of Europe or out of Rome or from invading their cities or destroying their cities. It's really focused on getting down to Jerusalem. And now it's getting kind of out of balance. It's like, if they're attacking your land, you need to drive them out. But if you just want to give them Jerusalem, again, if they'll stay on that side of the line, we'll stay on this side of the line. We'll Christianize this side of the world, and we'll send missionaries at a more convenient time or something. But anyway, they're not talking any, I don't hear that language. What I hear is we need control of Jerusalem. Because by this time in their theology is Jesus Christ can't come back. And you'll hear this echoed, building and echoing throughout the rest of church history. Until we do our job. And the Catholic Church felt they needed to do the job of taking Jerusalem so Jesus could return. And he would come back and meet them in Jerusalem. The Holy Roman Emperor Louis IX dies along with many of his men from drinking tainted water in Africa. So, again, crusader style. They found water. It's poisoned. It's bad. It kills them. All crusader territory in the Holy Land now is lost. So the crusader kingdom, within 150, 200 years, anything they had started is completely gone. Now, the castles remain, some of them. Acre falls back into the hands of Muslims, and basically the crusades are over. They last from 152 to 217 years, depending on how you do the math. You know, when you say it started, when you say it ended. So that's kind of that information. So there's the crusades. Basically, today all it means is there's a black mark on Christians, and that's why the Muslims are so mad at us, is because we did this to them. And it's interesting. You need to know some information. Okay, turn the page, 130. And we've got now between 1250 and 1517, and 1517 is going to be an important year. The Ottoman Caliphate is going to arise in 1517, and that's going to become the Ottoman Empire, which is going to end in World War I, 1923. The big news of World War I is really the collapse of this Ottoman Caliphate or the Ottoman Empire. It changed everything. That's when England takes control of Palestine. That's when Israel starts buying land and with a vision of coming back. Then World War II breaks out and the Jews are persecuted, Hitler. And then everybody kind of unites in a sense that the Jews need their own land and Israel's open because this has been defeated in World War I it's open. Britain is already controlling that area. And the United Nations basically gives, by 1948, you know, Israel's brought back in the land, and now we're in modern history. And you see, I mean, when you look at how much chunks of time we're going through, when they talk about history in 2016, or they talk about 9/11 is what was that, 2001, right? They're going to tie, all of this is going to be tied into 1920. See, 1923 to 2016, I mean, that's not even 100 years. I mean, that's not yet, the Crusades lasted 155 years. So what I'm saying is, the fall of this Ottoman Empire, it seems like this Ottoman Empire, the Ottoman Caliphate that's going to rise in 1517, is long, long ancient history. It has nothing to do with us. Maybe you could tie it together somehow. But that's going to take control and put pressure on Europe up until 1923, that's when it's finally dissolved. It actually fell in 1919 and 1921, but finally was officially dissolved in 1923. And that opened up the Middle East again. And Europe came in and started rearranging things, which leads to where we're at today. So what's happening, we're in a place now where these events are directly going to have an effect on us today. Well, let's see how. So between 12, going back to page 130, the top there, between 1250, the end of the Crusades, until 1517, the caliphate, or the power of the Muslim world, is in Egypt. And it's called the Mamluk dynasty, or the Mamluk caliphate would be more accurate. So very quickly, in 1354, Muslims, or the Ottoman Turks, and that's coming out of Asia, conquer the Christian Byzantine fortress at Gallipoli, on a peninsula on the European side of the Aegean Sea. Again, you can see my map. If you know where Greece is at, you've got the European side of that. It'd be on the west side. They conquered that area in Thrace, and this now opens up the opportunity for Muslims to advance north into Serbia and Hungary. So if you think about your map, or you see a map there, they've gone over and they've conquered the west side of the Greek. We know where Corinth is and Athens. They're on the other side, and they got control of that peninsula. So they can come over from Asia and just move straight north into Europe if they keep that control of the western coast. And so now they're going to use that. Like the Crusaders were trying to use Egypt to get up into Jerusalem and never succeeded. The Muslims now have come over to Greece. And now from Greece, they've got a direct shot up into the European. And if you think about it, all those cities, all those countries on that side, you know, south of Russia and in that area, those are all Muslims. You know, they're all Muslim people today. Well, let's keep reading. In 1375, the Muslim Mamluks take Sis, a city of Armenia, that would be north of Turkey, bring in the end of the Armenian independence. Armenians had been Christians since the earliest days of the book of Acts, and now they've lost their independence, and they are now a Muslim state. 1382, Muslim Turks conquer the European city of Sofia in Bulgaria, in the Balkans. Now that's in Europe. 1543, Muslim Turks capture Constantinople and kill Constantine the 11th. This ends the Roman Empire in the East. So 1453 is a red letter year. The Byzantine Empire, or the what we would even say the Roman Empire, falls in 1453. Now you say, well, the Roman Empire fell in 400 with the barbarians coming in. True, but Constantine had enough foresight to move the capital over to Constantinople and forfeit Rome to the barbarians coming from the north, the Europeans. And he moved over to Constantinople, and they regrouped and just reduced their kingdom to half. And that has held its ground until 1453. And now the Byzantine, which is the Roman Empire, the Byzantines, the Christian form of the Roman Empire, has collapsed and is now in the hands of the Muslims. So the Roman Empire, there's different dates you can establish for the fall of the Roman Empire, but here's a good contender, 1453. 1456, Muslims capture Athens, Greece. 1563, Muslims capture Bosnia. You ever met someone from Bosnia? I mean, I have. I've got students from Bosnia. In 1467, Muslims conquer the land, which is Herzegovina, which is in southern portion of Bosnia. Muslims in 1493, Muslims invade Croatia, north of Bosnia. So now they're in Bosnia, going north into Europe. Muslims invade Dalmatia, which is the coastal land in west of Bosnia. 1499, Muslims defeat the military fleet of Venice. That's the fleet that was supposed to help the Christians come across and wouldn't help them. And the city surrenders to the Sultan. 1501, Muslims conquer Persia. Again, now, what's important about that is they're going back to the east. Not only are they going west, they've lost some territory in the east, and they're spreading back towards the east. 1515, Selim I, Sultan of Turkey. Notice, Turkey, it's going to be the Ottoman Empire, conquers eastern Anatolia and Kurdistan. Again, we're going up into that area by the Black Sea. When you start talking about Gog and Magog and people from the north, that's the area that they're taking there. Selim I defeats Egyptian forces near... Now again, this is Selim I. He's coming out of Turkey, and the head of the empire right now is not the Ottoman Empire, but it's the Egyptian caliphate. So he's putting pressure on Egypt, and that's going to fall, which shifts the caliphate up into Turkey, or the Ottoman Empire. So he's setting the foundation. 1515, 1516, Selim is setting the stage for the fall of the Egyptian caliphate and the establishment of the Ottoman caliphate, which is Turkey, which is the Ottoman Empire, which is going to run until 1517. In 1517, Muslim Turks conquer Cairo, and that's the Ottoman Turks. The Ottoman Empire. Cairo has fallen. Mecca surrenders. I mean, Mecca was under the control of the Egyptian. Now again, this is Muslim fighting Muslim here. The Egyptian caliphate is going to fall to the Turks or the Ottomans, which is going to be the Ottoman Empire. And now it says Mecca surrenders. So now the head of, you know, the Washington, D.C. of Islam has now surrendered to the Ottoman caliphate. Egypt is now history. Now we've got a change right here. And in you get the next thing right there, you've got 1517 to 1923. The rest of this history now until 1523 is going to be about this Ottoman caliphate that has pushed itself up into Europe already between 1250 and 1517. They pushed themselves over into Persia. They've gone to Egypt and crushed the caliphate in Egypt, and now they are the center of the Muslim empire, the Muslim world. And they're going to continue to expand. And if you look now very quickly, 1517 to 1923 on the little train there on the west or on the right side, the Western world, these are the cities that are going to be fighting. Belgrade, Hungary, Rhodes, India, Cyprus, Venice, Poland, the Holy Roman Empire, Russia, and Greece. And it's going to lead up to World War I. You see, I got a little World War I soldier on the coal car, if you would. That's where this is going to go until World War I. And then you can see the train of Islam coming. And very quickly, I'll just read through those numbers there. And this is what we're going to talk about here on the next page. But in 1521, Muslims conquer Belgrade, the largest city in Serbia. 1521, Muslims invade Hungary. 1527, jihad is called against India. 1546, Muslims occupy Moldova next to Ukraine. I mean, we're getting into Russian territory. 1560, and they will enter Russia. Muslims defeat the Spanish fleet of ships in 1560. I mean, they're fighting some of the greatest seafaring people over on from the Atlantic Ocean. 1570, Muslims plunder the city of Nicosia on Cyprus, just that's in the Mediterranean Sea. 1620, Muslims defeat army of Poland. I think it's Polandus, but I think it should be Poland. I'd have to go back and check that. What is that? That's a typo. What is that? Yeah, that's Poland. That must be some kind of typo there. I typed that myself, so that's my fault. Muslims declare war on the Holy Roman Empire and invade Transylvania. Again, notice that. 1663, the Muslims declare war on the Holy Roman Empire. I mean, that's European Christianity. 1711, the Muslims are going to be at war with Russia. Did you know that? Russia was fighting the Muslims in 1711. 1809, Muslims make a treaty with Britain. Did you know that? Britain doesn't say, just get out of here, we're not going to mess with you. Britain has to negotiate a treaty with the Muslims in 1809. They've just lost the Americas in 1776, if you want to say that. And now they're getting Britain is getting pressure from Muslims, who Thomas Jefferson is also dealing with, because he can't do trade to the Mediterranean Sea or in the rest of the Atlantic because the Muslim pirates are invading his ships. So he sends warships over there and crushes the pirates. Did you know Thomas Jefferson fought Muslims? They're pirates in the Mediterranean Sea, interfering with our trade. Well, we're not going to negotiate. Go crush them. Thomas Jefferson. Muslims make a treaty with Britain. In 1822, Muslims massacre inhabitants of Greek island of Chios. A Muslim in 1827, Muslims enter Athens, Greece. 1885, Muslim Mahdi in Sudan kills British general. British evacuate Sudan. So Britain was in Sudan in 1885, but the Mahdi ends up having an assassination, and Britain flees. In 1914, Muslims call for a military jihad against... Are you ready for this? 1914. Think World War I. Muslims call for a military jihad against France, Russia, and Great Britain. That's 1914. Now, 100 years later, you think they're excited they're in Britain, and their mayor of London is a Muslim. It just happened that way. I mean, you think it just happened that way? Everybody's progressive and open-minded. I mean, I'm not making this up. This is just history. And right there in 1914, now that's where, at the beginning of the book, that's where I come in. That's where I dedicated the book to my grandfather. You see there at the dedication picture of him, because that's him coming back from, in 1918, coming back from France, where the Ottoman Empire was defeated. And he was, and his wife's brother, would be his brother-in-law, was killed. He's buried in France. And so they were there fighting the Ottoman Empire in World War I. And so it's just kind of interesting how that all just leads right up to, boom, my grandpa, who all I knew him as was a farmer, you know. Had a couple tractors, and I would watch him milk cows and squirt the cats with the milk in the mornings. We'd go out and milk cows and he'd squirt them. I'd get a kick out watching the cats get milk all over their face. And it's like I wish I could go back and talk to him about something besides the cats. You know. But anyway, isn't that amazing? I mean, and then we say, well, today, what's going on today? It's just a continuation. Something is happening. And it's just interesting to see this connection all the way from early Christianity, Islam being right there, putting pressure on Christianity this whole way through. And we're going to tie it in here at the end of the book. Okay, well, I just read about the train there, and what we have on the next page, we'll pick this up next week, and I'll read through the greater details of that. And I do want you, before we go, to look on page 133, and we're going to see, remember the train I just read through, you know, the Muslim train and the Western world train. Now, to get a perspective, I read it, but if you didn't understand it, that's where the battle, page 133, that's where those battles are being fought. Does it look familiar? I mean, when they're fighting over there in the Middle East somewhere, and they're down in the Arabian Peninsula or in Egypt, or it's like whatever. But those right there, that is all location. Those are the cities that I mentioned or I will be mentioning between the years 1570 and 1923 that Islam had entered. And again, Britain's not on there because they didn't go up to Britain. Britain was down in their own area. And if you look today, many of those countries have a Muslim influence in them. And when you get kids coming or fleeing as refugees from there, they're Muslim kids. Anyway, we'll talk about that. And then, of course, just to end, I've got to show you this. And on page 135, and I wrote this last summer, and I just say, is this the present crisis we are in? And you've got the Muslim jihad ISIS train coming there on the left, coming against the gay train from the Western world on the right. You see that? The flag and the coexist and the little, lesbian symbol there. And then you've got Islam coming at them. It's like, Anyway, is that the present crisis? Did we see it coming? I mean, again, you have your own political opinions, but it's not like I've been saying something unique, but it's like, how can a politician, how can someone have an opinion and say, I support, we need to open up and bring Islam into our country because they're a religion of peace, and they'll adapt, and they'll become one. We can't judge them, that they're a religion of peace. And at the same time, turn around and say, transgenders, what a great breakthrough, and homosexuality, and don't be judgmental. It's kind of like, I mean, for me, again, you can judge me because I'm judging someone else. But you are completely stupid and out of touch if you can say there's nothing wrong with bringing Islam into our country and letting it have part of our political, social system, and then turning and saying, isn't homosexuality and how open-minded we are, isn't it a great progressive thing? It's like, now I can see, now if one person is saying, bring Islam in, welcome Islam, we welcome all, okay? And if another person is saying, you know, I see it this way, I think it's fine to have homosexuality and transgender, and everyone, we got to be open-minded. But to be one mind, one person, and say, welcome Muslims, welcome homosexuals, come, let's all just live together in peace. It's like, that for me, it's just stupid. I mean, it's like, and I'm saying it, so I'm telling you, and you can judge me saying, well, Galen, you're stupid because it makes complete sense to me. Okay, I might be wrong. But it's like, where are people at? They don't know this agenda. They don't know this. They don't know the result, what this means. They don't know what homosexuality means. When they drop to a level where your culture accepts homosexuality, what that means to your culture. You've deconstructed reality so far that you may be hopeless. You can't even tell a family members, man and woman, mom and dad. You have no hope for your culture. And then look at Islam and say, well, they're fine, come on in. You know nothing about history. You completely deconstructed historical reality. And yet, you watch the news tonight, your political leaders, the people that are making your laws, that are driving the agenda of our country, are saying, and I'm not talking about Republicans or Democrats, I'm talking about all of them, are up trying to figure out how we can bring this together. And it's right there. You are heading towards Sodom, and you're going to be Lot standing, having to make a decision. The men are beating on your door, and they want to have sex with these two angelic men, and you want to protect them, but then you got the other choice. You got the daughters, and it's like, what's the right choice? You have no right. You're out of options. It's over. You have no right choice left. What could Lot have done? Bad choice A, bad choice B. And that's what America's being given right now. I mean, it's like, and we say, well, if we just get together and make some right decisions, they're gone. The right decisions are gone. It's now just a matter of being, and that's what's scary. And that's what that right there, 130, page 135, the present crisis, is that where we're at, where we are now? You're going to have this agenda meeting this agenda, and we're in the middle like Lot. And I'll say this, I said it last night. Lot was doing the right thing. He was out there in the middle saying, why are you doing this wicked thing? That's why Peter calls him righteous Lot. He was oppressed. He was tormented. Oppressed on the outside, like I said last night. Tormented on the inside. But he was at the right place. He was out there saying, why do you men want to do this wicked thing? And the men, of course, oppressed him, says, we'll treat you worse than we're going to treat those other people that we're talking about, bringing them out here. In other words, where was Lot? Hiding? Afraid? He was out in the middle of the wicked people saying, this isn't right. He was doing what Noah was doing. A preacher of righteousness. He was out saying, this is not right. Who's going to listen? No one. Who listened to Jeremiah? Who listened to Isaiah? In fact, Isaiah was told, no one's going to listen to you, but you've got to go tell them. And Lot was out there. He's standing in a group of men who want to gang rape two angels, and if not, they'll gang rape his daughters. It's like, and he stands up and says, why do you want to do this wicked thing? It's like, and they said, why are you judging us? It's like, that's right. Lot gets a bad rap, but he's in a culture. He's in the land of Sodom and Gomorrah. He's in a land like Canaan. And if this continues, that's us. We are in that land. And it's not like you're going to have an answer, but you're going to have to say, this is wicked. They go, why are you judging us? Because this is not even right. Well, what's your option? Say, well, you know, God loves everyone. Everyone's fine. There's no right or wrong. It's like, you either got to get on the train or get run over by the train. And right there in that example, there's two trains, and one of them's going to run over you, or me. Okay, that's nice and negative. But yet, at the same time, it's positive. It's like we have something to do, and that's stand up for righteousness and continue to say, Islam's got a problem. They don't have the true God. Homosexuality isn't right. I mean, what are you going to say? You've got to identify. You've got to be at least as righteous as Lot, who stood up and said, and they said, who sent you to play judge? It's like, and it says he was tormented in his righteous soul because he knew what was right. And this is, there's no way out of this. Okay. Next week, we go on through those years of the Ottoman Empire up to the World War I. And then where we're at today. Yes. Oh, my gosh, Larry. Thank you very much. Yeah. I'm going to Vegas. yeah. Well, wow, some sermons. No. Yeah, we're going to be going to Vegas. Thank you, Larry. We're going to go out. And we're going to see Vegas. I guess Lot was in Sodom. I'm going to Vegas. But no, Ben's graduating from a class there. My son Ben's graduating from an Air Force class there. So we're going to go out there for the big ceremony. And we're excited about going. We'll tell you about it when we get back. I had almost to wear a tux. I mean, it's an Air Force production, and so a suit's going to be fine. And we're going to turn into our 35th wedding anniversary. Tony wanted to go to Hawaii, but this came up. So, well, no, she wanted to go to the Mediterranean, not Mediterranean, but a cruise around the islands, and she was getting it organized. And then this came up, and we can't do both. And so we got something special planned. I hope it all comes together. It includes a helicopter and the Grand Canyon. But we'll tell you about that when we get back after it's, or watch on Facebook. We'll see if it works out. And, yeah, we're going to go see the Strip, but it may be a 7.5-minute visit, and I don't know. Yeah, isn't that funny? I give you that little speech, and then I'm going to Vegas, baby. Oh, hey, I'm going to pray if that's even possible right now. Father, we do thank you for your truth. We thank you for your word, and we do ask that we would search after you, search after the truth. And Father, we do ask that the things I say would be tempered with truth and reality and with other teachers and other Christians who have wisdom to add to the things I'm presenting. Father, we do want to walk in the truth and live a life that is pleasing to you at this time in history and, again, accomplish the things you've called us to. Again, we thank you for our country. We thank you for the churches. We thank you for our families. And we do pray for all of that tonight in Jesus' name. Amen. Thank you for your time.